from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan begin on Monday, and in our first half hour this morning, we'll talk with two constitutional scholars about what to watch for as the hearings begin and whether or not those hearings will offer anything revealing at all. One advocate for forthcoming behavior on the part of court nominees, Elena Kagan, or so she wrote in a book review 15 years ago. And then in our second half hour, California is now experiencing a whooping cough epidemic. We'll talk with a pediatrician and a public health official about what parents should do. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, Elena Kagan, begins her Senate confirmation hearings on Monday, the kind of hearings that in recent years have yielded little real information about what Supreme Court nominees are really like or likely to do once seated on the court. As one observer once put it, when the Senate ceases to engage nominees in meaningful discussions of legal issues, the confirmation process takes on an air of vacuity and farce. The person who wrote that assessment? Elena Kagan, in a book review she penned back in 1995. So will nominee Kagan be as forthcoming as book reviewer Kagan once espoused? What would make the upcoming hearings more revealing? Some thoughts now on the kinds of questions that ought to be asked and the kinds of qualities and experiences that are relevant to who a Supreme Court justice is likely to become. Joining us, Vikram Amar. He's professor of law and associate dean for academic affairs at the University of California Davis School of Law. Vikram Amar, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And joining us as well from New York, Barry Friedman. He's professor of law at New York University School of Law and author of the new book, The Will of the People, How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution. Barry Friedman, good morning as well.
Good morning to you.
Thanks both for joining us. Vikram Amar, first, you've written about that quote I just wrote from Elena Kagan's book review back in 1995. To what extent does that sort of put her on notice that she ought to be more forthcoming in the upcoming hearings?
Well, I think the article that she wrote, which was critical of a position that was advanced by another law professor from Yale, Stephen Carter, to the effect that the Senate really ought to refrain from too much detailed substantive examination of a nominee's views, I think that article that she wrote kind of at the very least gives senators something to throw back in her face when she, as I expect that she will, kind of resists being forthcoming with too many specifics. In particular, she said two things about the process, in addition to the fact that the Senate should be engaged in a more substantive inquiry. First, she said that to really get to know a nominee, you have to descend beneath the general labels like textualist or originalist or believer in stare decisis. You have to really descend to the level of specific disputes and specific cases to really find out anything. And second, she said that the reasons that nominees had been giving for not answering specific questions were bogus. So when she gives some of those same very reasons for resisting specific questions, I think some senators will throw these words and arguments she made back in her face.
So do you think, Vikram Amar, though, that she will be then just as resistant to that sort of specificity, that despite her own advice from 15 years ago, that she's likely to say, I can't possibly comment on a decision that will come before me?
Well, I don't know if she'll be just as resistant as nominees have been over the last decade plus, but she's got nothing to gain by being forthcoming. She has the votes to pass unless there's some huge bombshell. The Democrats aren't going to block her, even though many of them would like more information about her specific views as well. And so from her individual point of view, if I were advising her as a friend, I would tell her to say as little as possible. I just don't think that's necessarily in the Senate's or the country's best interest. But my guess is she will probably admit that her thinking has evolved with respect to the proper confirmation process, mm-hmm. and that she thinks now that it's not quite as easy to share everything as she did when she was a young law professor 15 years ago.
Barry Friedman, she also wrote in the review that she thought the last revealing hearing was the Robert Bork hearing back in the late 1980s, and of course we know what happened there. Do you see any chance that this hearing will go any differently, and what would make it be a more revealing hearing this time around?
Well, you know, the thing about the Bork hearings was that Bork, who was under fire at the time that the hearings began, decided to come and tell all. He spent a lot of time talking about his philosophy for interpreting the Constitution, originalism, and how it would play out in specific cases. And it was that very willingness to discuss all these issues that eventually laid everything out on the table and resulted in his not being confirmed. So Kagan doesn't start in the same position as Bork did, and I don't think there's any way she's going to descend to the level of detail that he did. I agree with Vic about that completely.
Joining us this morning, Barry Friedman, author of the new book, How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution. He teaches at the NYU School of Law. And Vic Amar, the Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the University of California, Davis School of Law. We welcome your questions and thoughts, too. What would you like to see asked at the Supreme Court nominee hearings for Elena Kagan that get underway on Monday? Here's the number if you'd like to pose a question to either Professors Friedman or Amar. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or email us at forum@kqed.org. Barry Friedman, in a piece that was in the Washington Post last week, written by the former Deputy Solicitor General during the Reagan administration, Don Ayer, he makes the point that he thinks the now famous analogy that John Roberts offered up during his confirmation hearing, that a Supreme Court justice is like an umpire, you just call balls and strikes, is wrong. He wrote that, quote, "a mechanical objective decision-making is not what the Supreme Court does ever." He goes on to say that a real uncertainty exists and that you need substantial arguments on both sides, and they can't be easily dismissed as invalid or wrong, and that these cases must be resolved by deciding which collection of arguments is the more compelling, that it's not a simple matter of balls and strikes. Do you agree with Don Ayer's point on that?
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I'll give you an interesting statistic. I don't promise to have this precisely right, but it's roughly right. Since John Roberts became the Chief Justice, there have been a number of 5-4 decisions in which the justices split on what we think of as ideological grounds. And in those, the court has gone rough in the conservative direction roughly 70% of the time or something like that. So if it's just calling balls and strikes, it's an interestingly shifting strike zone that we have. in reality, and if anybody thinks about it for about 2 seconds, the cases that come to the Supreme Court are hard. They're hard for a reason. They've gone through lots of other courts, and lots of people have worked to resolve them, and there are good arguments on both sides. And so to think that it's mechanical is just to engage in farce, really.
So, Sikamar, how do you get at that then? If by definition what the justices do is complex, that it's not a simple matter of just balls and strikes, or at least we're not sure where the strike zone entirely is, what kinds of questions would get at the way in which a nominee would resolve those kinds of complicated issues?
Well, one tack is to kind of ask a nominee questions about his or her approach to judging. How strongly do you believe in the text? What do you think it takes to overrule an earlier Supreme Court case? How much and in what ways does the history surrounding the enactment of a provision of the Constitution bear on its meaning? The problem with those general methodological questions is that they're pitched at such a high level of generality that everyone can answer them the same. Everyone believes in the text. No one's going to say they don't start with the text of the document. No one's going to say the history is irrelevant. No one's going to say they overturn cases willy-nilly. The question is really how all these pieces fit together into a person's philosophy or ideology. And the only way, I think, to know that or to get at that is to ask nominees about recent or current disputes and ask for their tentative views about how those disputes should be resolved. So, for example, You know, you could ask somebody, who do you think got the better of the constitutional argument in the case 2 years ago involving the Second Amendment and the District of Columbia, and whether the Second Amendment really does protect an individual's right to keep and bear arms? There you had an opinion by Justice Scalia laying out one vision of history and one approach to interpreting the Constitution, and you had a different vision by Justice Stevens. You really need to descend to that level to get a feel for what kind of textualist or what kind of historian a nominee is likely to be on the court. Let me sum it up this way. When the questions you ask could be answered the same way by Antonin Scalia and William Brennan, and often they would both give the same kind of answer to the question, then the question really isn't worth asking.
So what qualities are you trying to discern when you do ask those sort of specific questions, Barry Friedman? Are there qualities of the mind, of the intellect, of life experience? What is it that is particularly relevant to weighing and sorting these complicated sorts of cases?
Yeah, well, I'll answer that, but let me interject something that I think gives you a slight twist to what Vic had to say. President Lincoln once said that it's precisely because we can't ask a nominee their views that we have to know their views before we nominate them. And one of the very odd things that's happened in the confirmation process over the last few years is that we've come to nominating people whose views we don't know precisely because if we do know them, then there's a political fight. So we've gotten ourselves into a very, very strange place. Now, you still can figure out whether they're generally bright enough to be on the court, but again, it's going to be shocking if we have a nominee who's, in these times, who's not going to meet that test. Some people perform brilliantly, like the Chief Justice John Roberts did, and some might perform less well. I actually think the problem's even worse than Vic makes it seem for this confirmation hearing, because I think there are some pointed questions you could ask at a general level that would still be revealing. You know, you could ask a justice who adheres to views about the original Constitution, even as just part of the analysis, how do you justify things like women's equality, which weren't in the original document in any way? But in this hearing, the Democrats have no incentive to ask hard questions of Elena Kagan, and the Republicans are never going to ask that kind of question because they don't like the answer.
Let's hear what our listeners think of the kinds of questions that ought to be asked. We'll go to Colin first in San Francisco. Colin, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Actually, I would hope that the senators would ask Professor Kagan about a opinion that she made during the Clinton administration. She had written a note indicating her disapproval of a California Supreme Court decision prohibiting a landlady from discriminating against an unmarried couple. The landlady had cited her First Amendment rights as the reason why she didn't want to rent to the unmarried couple. Does this indicate that Judge Kagan might actually be sympathetic to arguments that fired persons can discriminate against gays and lesbians under their First Amendment rights?
Colin, thanks for the question. Vic Amar, is that the kind of question that could be revealing, or how would she swat that away if she wanted to?
Well, I haven't read that particular memo she wrote, but that is the kind of question that should be asked, will be asked, and could be revealing, because even though the nominees have deflected hard questions, sometimes they seem more inclined to want to give an answer or to feel compelled to give an answer when they're asked about their own past writings. It doesn't make sense to me that you should be free to talk about an issue just because you've talked about it in the past, if otherwise it's an inappropriate basis or subject for questioning. But you will have to address specific things she wrote. But let me mention one other thing. It kind of builds on what Barry said. This is a particularly unusual and hard case, I think, for the Senate, in part because most of the writings that Kagan has, she had in her capacity as a lawyer when she worked for an administration, either the Obama administration or the Clinton administration. So it's really hard for anyone to know whether she was speaking kind of out of her own views or in anticipation of what she thought her bosses would want. Ironically, most of the time when you have a law professor who's nominated for the Supreme Court, you can get some decent idea of his or her views from all of her academic writings, because those writings, unlike a memo you write when you're a lawyer, are written for yourself and nobody else. So a law professor, when writing articles, doesn't answer to a client. But Professor Kagan doesn't have a big corpus of her own academic writings. So unlike Robert Bork or Nino Scalia, you can't really glean that much from what she's done as a law professor, which makes the questioning all the more important. But as Barry said, neither side is really probably going to get into it in an effective way.
One part of her past that has gotten a lot of attention, Barry Friedman, is the decision she made when she was dean of the Harvard Law School about limiting the access of military recruiters because of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell ruling. How is that legit territory? Does it reveal something about how Kagan would perform as a Supreme Court justice?
Well, it's certainly legitimate. I mean, there's no question about that. It's unclear how revealing it is. The action that she took is very similar to the action taken by many, many law deans at the time. And I don't think she's particularly susceptible to some sort of anti-military attack. You know, it's also been widely reported that she gave a quite moving lecture at West Point in which she really nodded her head to the incredible role that the military plays and how much respect she has for them. And I think that's an endemic of Elena Kagan's life. She's been centrist and careful and thoughtful, and she's taken strong views, but often in opposite directions, in a balanced kind of way, where she'll say, that makes sense in this context, but something else makes sense in another context. So we're going to hear about it without any question whatsoever, but I'm not sure that it's going to do much damage.
And what about Barry Friedman exploring that, the way in which she would function perhaps as a centrist on the court, in the way that her predecessor, the seat on the court that she's replacing, John Paul Stevens, did? In other words, someone who can function on both sides, who can play this sort of conciliatory role and bring people together in a certain kind of consensus, which is often thought to be one of the key ingredients or attributes that's necessary for an effective justice. Is there a way that the Senate hearings or the questioning that goes forward can get at that sort of role?
I think you're undoubtedly going to hear a great deal about that. I think it's both a point in her favor and very true in her case that she has, throughout her career, reached out in different directions and shown an ability to find compromise and find a sound place to be. That's why there are a number of prominent conservatives who have been supportive of her, and I think that probably appealed greatly to President Obama when he selected her, in part because it would make the confirmation hearings easier, but in part because I think he shares that view in many respects.
And Vic Amar, though, is this another area where it's hard to get at anything very real? Because as you were saying earlier, if someone is asked a question about how they would function in a across both sides kind of way, they're going to give a kind of nice, soft answer. And whether that person is Antonin Scalia or someone much more to the left, they're not going to necessarily say, well, I'll never do that.
Yes, except that in her case, she has a very strong track record. She's got a stronger track record of kind of institutional navigation, if you will, than she does articulation of constitutional views. As dean of the Harvard Law School, a very complicated, very political, very striven when she got there place, she demonstrated the ability to work with people across the spectrum and in some instances bring them together, although obviously she has her detractors there as well. I think the bigger question is not whether she's good at that stuff, but rather whether it really matters at the Supreme Court. That's the kind of thing I think it takes years to have an effect doing. And, for example, you mentioned Justice Stevens. When I clerked for Justice Blackmun in 1990, certainly Justice Stevens was not a coalition builder there. And I think some of the kind of characterizations that he put together, these coalitions later in his career, I think they may be a little exaggerated. Hmm. Remember, these are 9 very strong-willed, very smart, very confident people. I'm not sure anyone's going to really move Justice Kennedy very much from what he wants to do in these big 5-4 cases. But if someone is, it's going to take years and years, not right away.
Let's hear more of what our listeners would like to find out about Elena Kagan. Again, if you have a question for either Vic Amar or Barry Friedman, call us at 866-733-6786. To Mark in Redwood City. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, Senator O'Connor, I think, was one of the first to reference a foreign jurisdiction in one of her opinions. And I'm wondering what your team there thinks of the appropriateness of the U.S. Supreme Court referring to opinions made in by the World Court or by courts of Japan or other nations, and whether that's constitutional. And it seems to me that that's a bit of a... So I'm curious what you guys think of that direction.
Mark, thanks. Barry Friedman?
Yeah, so it's a complicated question, but it's one that I think in many ways is often misunderstood. So I don't know that anybody on the Supreme Court now thinks that we ought to be bound under the United States Constitution by anything that another jurisdiction has held. Nonetheless, it's actually been true since the founding that the Supreme Court justices referred to international law and the law in other jurisdictions as they've decided, as they reached their conclusions. The issue became one of political note because in some high-profile controversial cases involving the death penalty or involving gay rights, some of the justices were very explicit in pointing to norms in other places and saying we ought to pay attention to that, and that was something that, the other justices, and particularly the political right, then seized on. But we shouldn't be naive that the courts often look to foreign sources and that nobody thinks that they ought to bind us. They're just informative.
Barry Friedman joining us this hour. He's professor of law at New York University School of Law and the author of the new book, The Will of the People, How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution. On that topic, Barry Friedman, what you write about, your thesis, as I understand it, seems to be that public opinion actually does influence the Supreme Court and tends to sort of pull it back if it sort of leans too far in one direction or the other. Is that a fruitful territory to explore during this hearing? And what sort of question would you like to know about as far as how Kagan responds to the role of public opinion?
So I'll give you two very contradictory answers to that question. Argue with myself a little bit. The book, as you note, makes the case that the Supreme Court is at some remove still always accountable to the American people. And because of that, the justices' decisions tend over time in the big cases to come into line with public opinion. And you can actually see with the Roberts Court. I mean, we have a very conservative majority on that court. And other than the Citizens United case, which we could talk about, it's actually been a remarkably quiet term. And I think it's much quieter that it would be if the justices could do whatever they want without worrying about public opinion. So I think that's what happens. Now, I don't think, however, that we want the justices to consciously be following public opinion. I mean, what's the point of having a Supreme Court if they're just looking at the Gallup poll to decide what they think? So there's some tension there. I think it would be interesting to ask the nominee what role public opinion plays. Some of the other justices have spoken to that. Justice Rehnquist spoke to it, and Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg. So I would be very curious to hear Elena Kagan talk a little bit about what the relationship of public opinion is to the job that they do and the meaning of the Constitution.
Squeeze in one last listener question. Selby in San Francisco, just a quick question, if you would, please. Selby,
Hello?
Are you with us? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
quick
sure.
question.
Yeah, hi. Professor Amar, a former student of yours at the largest law school west of the Mississippi. My question is, if you have any opinion about what kind of vetting of a nominee is appropriate before the confirmation hearings, or put another way, can we kind of as voters or as citizens rest assured that the administration has gotten at least some sense, maybe a better sense than we will ever have about Professor Kagan's position on, say, you know, the Proposition 8 trial in California.
Selby, let me hold you there. Vic, I'm sorry, just a quick response, please.
Sure. Nice to hear from you. It's a great question. Although presidents disclaim any specific litmus test questioning of nominees, I think Democrats and Americans generally are right in suspecting that President Obama knows Elena Kagan pretty well, or he wouldn't have appointed her.
We'll have to hold it there. Much more on the Supreme Court hearings, of course, in the weeks ahead. Vic Amar at the University of California School of Law at Davis and Barry Friedman at NYU. Thanks both very much for participating in our first half hour today. Coming up in our second half hour of Forum, we're going to turn our attention to the whooping cough epidemic that is now besetting the state of California. We'll talk about what parents should do, what the sorts of public health concerns are. That's coming up in our next half hour. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.